Good evening. At this time, Mel, T-T-Y, and Tech, T-T-R-I-W, in a thing they call the TechNet. This is TechNet number 1250 of the series that began in September of 1982. Long time ago, back in the Dark Ages. Main purpose is education. Amateur radio operators gather at this time, at this machine, and help each other. That's what the main purpose of the technical net is. We teach each other how radio really works. What is the audible wire? The better antenna, the better feed line. What's the favorite transmitter? What's the different kind of ham radio? An FM repeater, 2-meter ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. If you happen to get bored with this kind or want to explore some of the others, there are 25 more of them to try. A person trying to do this technique by giving Mel and Dick the call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question for a comment for the net. The sign-in would sound like this. KE2DJ, Eric, and yes. That was a triple, but I got the Rich, Bob, and Alex. Do I have you guys right?
That'd be two of us, but hopefully I'm not doubling on anybody, Nick. And I do have a question tonight.
Okay, so Bob is with a yes. Alex, is he with a yes?
Yeah, 3 days old, yes. It's really buzzing here.
Okay. And Rich, N2EO, is yours also a yes? Are you going to be discussing your new rig, your new repaired piece of equipment? Maybe I was wrong. Was Rich N2EO in there?
W2OAY. Joe.
Yes.
Okay, so I may be wrong on Rich. So we've got Bob, Alex, and Joe in that order so far. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letter's name. And that yes, if you do have a question or a comment.
Good evening, all. Take the KEY.
And that was Mel with a yes. He's always got a yes. And we also have a ball. That's the last two around tonight, ball. Maybe we'll pick up Paul later. One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet who has a question or a comment? Give me a call letter, name, and the word yes. Okay, Mike with a no, Rich with a yes. Okay, the first one we heard pile up was Bob. Boy, Bob, what would you like to talk about tonight, Bob?
Okay, Dick, it is W2OSR. As you know, I've been working on a 2-meter beam. I told you, I think earlier last week, that I had managed to hear you on the input on the TechNet last week. Anyway, I've been trying the method that you gave me for matching, and I'm sure if I could play around with the capacitors, I could probably get it to work eventually. As it is right now, I've got it on the frequency I want to operate at, and I've got a 2-to-1 VSWR, which I would like to try and get a little bit lower if possible, so I'm considering maybe adding a hairpin match to it. I don't know what kind of guidance you can give me on that. Over.
Okay, when you and I last discussed this one, Bob, I pointed you to an article that I wrote that is available on the website of Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. Go there and go to the bottom of his first microwave page, and you'll find the IP matching by K2RIW. When you follow that procedure, which was to extend the length or shorten the length electronically, like holding a piece of copper tape on the end of a long stick, and outside of the field of the antenna, you put it near the tips of the dipole. So this is why either gets better or worse. That tells you whether the dipole wants to be longer or shorter. And Also then by putting a variable capacitor across the feed point terminals, wherever your feed point terminals are, by a bendable piece of copper tape across the terminals, where one of the terminals has some copper tape, a friction paper tape, to insulate it. So with the bendable piece of copper tape across the terminals, and gives you a variable capacitor. By holding the tuning wire to the sensor, you've got a variable capacitor, which really is loading the ends of the dipole, and allows you to find out, does the dipole want to be shorter or longer? So the bottom line is, when you're looking with a standing wave ratio meter, you adjust those two parameters. I defy you, Bob Batchelor, to find any Yagi on planet Earth where you cannot make the driven element equal 50 ohms resistive. So when you did that procedure, Bob, what did you find?
Okay, I am seeing where I ran into one of my problems. I do not have a small variable capacitor, so I think that may be the next step, is to pick one of those up at a ham fest someplace. The way the antenna is built, I can adjust the length of the driven element without any trouble. I've got foot joints on it, and it's adjustable in length. I just don't think I have the value of the capacitor right to get everything to fall in exactly where I want it to be. So that's probably the next thing to do.
Hey, Bob, you don't need a variable capacitor. As the article indicates, by putting a piece of copper tape across the terminals of your feed point, of your Yagi, where one of those terminals is insulated with paper tape, and you take that piece of copper tape and you bend it toward or away from the one with the paper tape. That is a gimmick IQ variable capacitor. You're just trying to prove you can get a good impedance match. Once you've proven that to yourself with these gimmicking devices, the sliding rods at the end or top hat capacitors at the end that you bend, again made out of copper tape, you bend them with a small wooden stick, and the piece of copper tape at the feed point, you bend it to make a variable capacitor. You want to prove to yourself that you can get a perfect match with these gimmicking devices. Once you have found the perfect match, to then convert that over to a more permanent-looking capacitor that is rated for the weather and for your particular power output and so on, that's an easy transition. But the first step is to first find the value of capacitor and the electrical length of the dipole that gives you a perfect impedance match for your particular Yagi. So you don't have to go out and buy a capacitor yet. By that copper tape across the terminals, you make a gimmick variable capacitor just to prove that it can be done. And by a number of techniques, I can tell you what is the value of that capacitor, the one that you make out of the copper tape, and then you substitute it with something that is transmitter rated and weather rated, if you know what I mean. So there's another step you can do even before you buy any more components there, Bob, in my opinion. W2OSR, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, as they used to say years ago, back to the drawing board. Okay. I'll have to try that out to see if I see what materials I have around the house that I can make up a gimmick capacitor. I'm not sure. I might get too high a capacitance just trying to twist two insulated wires together, and again, the Q may not be high enough.
Yeah, the problem with twisting the wires is that it's a cut-and-try type situation, and you might pass through the sweet spot. See, with the bendable piece of copper tape across the terminal, you can make the capacitance go from 0 to, let me pick a number, 50 picofarad, just by moving the copper tape with the wooden stick as you stand out of the field of the antenna. It is a thoroughly variable thing, and as you move that piece of copper tape flapper up and down with the long wooden stick, the tiny little diameter wooden stick as you stand out of the field, you're watching your standing wave ratio meter, and it's a little bit like a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. By the meter going through its dip, you'll know when you're in the right direction. And you juggle those two things, length of dipole, and by the way, so let me repeat what's going on here, because this is an extremely well-kept secret. I've tried having it published by ARRL, and they've turned it down on some of the VHF website, VHF conferences, as part of the conference paper, It's been published in the United Kingdom. It's been published in Australia. It's been published in New Zealand. The United States thinks that magic dipoles is boring. Nobody knows how to do it. The magic thing that is thoroughly kept as a secret from all of us is that as you make any dipole, whether it's part of a Yagi or it's out in free space, let me drop. As you make any dipole longer, the resistive component becomes higher. Longer, more resistant. Shorter, less resistant. So by doing nothing but adjusting the length of any dipole, the resistive component can be made to go from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohm inclusive. Length equals value of resistance. Period. That's the good news. The bad news is that you have the right temperature where you can see the resistive component and the reactive component independently, like a good network analyzer or one of the RX meters, to make the resistance make it eat exactly 50 ohms is relatively easy. Most of us only have a Berg watt meter or a directional coupler or a Viswah meter, and we can only see the total Viswah, which is the resistive mismatch plus the reactive mismatch. So life gets a little bit more complicated, but with the iterative process, you'll always get there. So length equals resistance. Once you choose the right length to give you the 50 ohm resistance, you got it. And most Yagis, most good Yagis, the dipole ends up around 20 ohms resistive. So you always want to have to raise it. Therefore, almost always with a Yagi, you're going to be lengthening the dipole to get it to go from 20 ohms up to 50. When you do that, the extra length makes the resistance just right, but almost always there's some reactance left over. The dipole now looks inductive because it's a little bit longer than a quarter of a hand wave. And the fact that the dipole ends up a little bit longer than the reflector, don't let that scare you. For people who will stop right there, even though they get a good match, they refuse to go there. They think the antenna's going to explode. So there's usually some inductive reactions left over. When you put that flapper capacitor across the terminals, you cancel the inductive reactance. It has a little bit of re-reaction with the resistive component. There's a little bit of interaction between the two. But you lengthen the driven dipole until the Viswah goes the lowest. You add the capacitor and move it around until the Viswah goes the lowest. Then you go back to the length and make the Viswah go lower yet. So if you have no meter that can independently show you the resistive component and the reactive component, you can only look at the total Viswah. Doesn't matter. You'll walk the two into the right direction until the Viswah hits the bottom, and you can make the Viswah go to 1.0 to 1. And I'm not kidding, if you want to do that.
Repeater, time out.
The technique has more than enough range to do what you want. You can match a resistive component from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohm. Nobody you and I know, Bob, goes beyond 1,000 ohms on the high side or less than 1 ohm on the low side. And with that flapper capacitor across the terminals, you can make all reactants disappear. You can make a perfect match out of any Yagi if you follow the procedure. And then to convert those gimmicks, the nice thing about pushing with the wooden rod on the flapper capacitor and across the terminals, the feed point terminals, it is a continuous device. And you're doing the measurement under working conditions. When you go up there with a twisted wire pair, your fingers and your whole hand in the field means that you're not making a measurement at that time. You twist the wires and you assume the capacitance is going to increase. Yes, it will. But maybe you jump too far. And you can't see it happening while you're doing it. Oh, I guess a really smart guy could make some kind of a wooden stick-like device with two holes on the end where the wires plug into the holes, and he stands back and he twists the stick, he twists the dowel, and it, therefore twisting the wires. So a smart guy could do it with twisted wires and make the measurement while he is doing the work, if you know what I mean. But the flapper capacitor out of copper tape, in my opinion, is a much easier way to go. And then once you prove to yourself that, hey, I got the length right, I got the capacitance right, and now if you want to make that into a twisted pair of wires, or if you want to make it into a transmitting capacitor, or make it into some kind of an air-mounted physical object, those are all your choices. Or if you need any further fill in that, Bob. In other words, I apparently, up till now, haven't given you enough faith to go through the step-by-step process. I know the solution is there if you've got the faith to follow through. W2OSR, KQLIW.
Now, Case and JEY are telling me how to make a very simple flapper capacitor.
Okay, why don't you give them that information right now, Mel? Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, you need 2 pieces of printed circuit board. Copper on one side, that's, you know, like regular just plastic material on the other side. And now, a piece of printed circuit board on each terminal. So now, as the 2 pieces of printed circuit board pass over each other with the copper down, in other words, the copper is down, makes contact with the screw on each side. As they pass, the printed circuit boards pass over each other, the separation will be the copper down, the plastic, the plastic of the other one, and the other one is going to have the copper below it. So now you've got a very easily plastic variable capacity information. That is, once you get it to the proper point, you can then actually measure it or make it up or more permanent. But this way, you know, it's not, you know, at the mercy of a hand shaking. In other words, it's to be mounted fairly tight to tap this place, Dick, over.
Now, the one thing that's not clear to smell is that you've got overlapping pieces of single-sided copper-clad board, and the copper in both cases is touching a terminal. How do I stand off to one side and make that go from, let's say, 1 picofarad to 10 picofarad? How do I continuously tune that when I stand off to one side? In the case of the copper tape flapper capacitor, and I'm pushing on the overlapping piece of copper tape with that wooden stick, I have a continuously variable capacitor that I can watch while I'm standing off to one side. How do you do that with the overlapping pieces of printed circuit board? Is one of them mounted with a loose screw and you're rotating it over the other one? Is that how you're doing it, Seth Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Simply adjust the screw to the right tension so that, you know, it just has a little bit of, tension. It just has very, very small. You can actually put a board on it. I guess, like you said, not a board. If you make the one screw, you know, those tight to hold it, call that the static, and the other one is the rotor, and tap that one very slowly or put a piece of cord, like you say, on it. But this way, it's not, you know, so flimsy. You know, a lot of times with tape, I was trying that, that there's tape. You know, it flutters around up there, and it comes a little bit more solid. That after I got it adjusted, that I could then handle the situation to make measurements exactly what I came up with for a fixed capacitor. You know, Dick, I need something more, you know, stable over.
I like it. Now that I've got the picture, I like it. And that's an even better way. When I find out the piece of tape is a little bit too floppy and it won't hold its position, I change the size of the tape, I change the way it is, the way the bending of it is biased. There's a little bit of an art form there, and I've never had any trouble making anything from 0.1 picofarad to 100 picofarad, so to speak, by pieces of copper tape that I bend, and I properly shape them, having the right size, the length, the right length, and whatever. It's so easy for me to do that in less than 1 minute, that to me it's a solution. But I see what you're doing with the sliding pieces of the printed circuit board, where one slides over the other, and you're pushing it with a stick or pulling it with a string. Any of these things will work. Now, Bob's got a different step job. He's got 3 different solutions. He's got to choose which one he wants to do with his particular raw material. W2OSR, K2RIW. I'm hoping the next time we hear from you, Bob, you've got a solution.
Okay, Dick. Well, what I tried, and now I'm seeing that, you know, the error of my ways, in a sense, is I ran your method of matching through EasyMech. It came up with a capacitor value of, I think, 5.6 picofarad. The way the antenna is hooked, I couldn't tell what natural occurring capacitance is already there, so it's probably that would be a starting point. It's probably going to be something slightly lower than that, I'm guessing anyway. But now you give me a technique. What I think I can do is I've got a couple of pieces of bar stock. I can just lay masking tape on one piece and then, or even black electrical tape on one piece as my dielectric and just try bringing them closer and closer together and seeing, you know, when I get the match point.
Okay. Apparently you don't own any copper tape because you're not using it. It's such a fast material for doing this. Little pieces of copper tape on the tips of the dipole. As you bend them toward the dipole, you know, toward the rod itself or away from the rod, it changes their capacitance, which is electronically changing the length of the dipole. You don't have to have slider pieces of tubing at the tips of the dipole to change the electronic length, and that's what we're doing here. Electronic length doesn't have to be a physical length. And the same thing with copper tape in the center. Turns out that people have put much too much faith in modeling programs when it comes to Yagi. My good friend Kent Bricken, Britain, WA5BJB, is preparing a speech as we speak that he's going to be delivering at the Central State DHF Society in Chicago in the end of July of this year. And the Central States Committee are going to hear lots and lots of stories of people who modeled various kinds of antennas on computer modeling programs. They assumed the modeling program was infinitely accurate, that when they built the real antenna, they got different results. They assumed that something was wrong with the real antenna, the model was right, and the real world was wrong. They got it backwards. The modeling program makes a number of approximations. It doesn't model every single millimeter or thousandth of an inch of the antenna, its diameter, the diameter of the boom, the thickness of the boom, the thickness and dielectric constant of the mounting washers that are insulating the elements from the boom, what you should do on VHF antennas. All of those things are not being properly modeled. The modeling program gets you into the ballpark. You will never get to home plate on the modeling program, even on a simple dipole. And you've got something as elaborate as a Yagi. When the program predicted it once 5.6 picofarad, maybe the real number is either 3.1 or 12.9. It told you the rough order of magnitude of what capacitance is required. And you put in that exact value of capacitor, it didn't work, and you assumed something was wrong. You assumed the program was right. We have all of us who do computer modeling with antennas and putting extremely too much faith into the modeling program lately. There's a whole lot of people falling into that trap.
Repeater, time out.
Any smart antenna engineer, after he comes up with a modeled solution, then does something called PCO, post-computer optimization. That's a fancy way of saying the Edisonian approach. The ham radio operator goes out with the real ham radio technique, and he tinkers. That's the real world. The computer program is some kind of an ideal, overly simplistic world. You got to be careful not to put too much faith in it. When it predicts a particular pattern, it's probably medium good. When it predicts a particular gain, I'm starting to get skeptical. When it predicts a particular number of picofarads required at the center of a dipole, with your method of construction of the dipole, which may be different than the way the computer program modeled it, and it predicts 5.6 picofarads, I wouldn't stake my life on that one, Bob. So, you also have a lot of faith in the program, and not all of that faith is legal, if you know what I mean. So, good luck with that project. Once you know what you're doing, and you can vary the length electronically and the capacitance at the center electronically, and you watch that standing wave ratio meter, assuming it's well designed and well balanced, where it measures 1.1 viswar when you put a known good dummy load on it. Make sure you've got a good standing wave ratio meter to begin with, one that's got high directivity. When in doubt, reverse the meter, input and output lead, and now it should the calibration procedure and the viswire you read should be exactly reversed, if you know what I mean. So forward power should go to zero and reverse power should become unity when you're using it backwards. So a good viswire meter into a good dummy load will pass that test. If you're starting off with a poorly calibrated or low directivity standing wave ratio meter, then the perfection you're tuning for would be a phony perfection, if you know what I mean. So good luck with that project. It's going to take a little bit more tinkering. The tinkering is the real world. The computer modeling is not the real world. I probably said that 5 times in a row. I wonder if you're beginning to believe me, Bob. W2OSR, K2RIW.
Okay, W2OSR. I know EasyNet can lie to you. Found that out a few times. That's why usually when I build some sort of an antenna, the elements are usually adjustable. Usually pretty good on the length of the everything except the driven element. Most of the other stuff is reasonably good on. That's why I made the driven element adjustable. I just got to, you know, monkey around getting the capacitor value right. That's all. At least I got a rough idea of how much I need. Okay, I'm going to let somebody else step up. I'm sitting in my car in front of the house. My wife went in about 15 minutes ago. So I think it's time I go and follow her before she decides it's time to call the divorce lawyer. 7-3, guys.
Good luck.
Hey, why one more comment?
Good luck with that project. Mel recognized. And later on, about an hour from now, we're going to give a nice long delay because I know Kent, the VA5BJB, is going to have a lot of comments on that. Kent has run the antenna gain measurement contest at Central States VHF Society as well as a number of other places, Microwave Update. He's been doing that kind of work for the last 10 or 20 years, and he has seen a zillion antennas where the computer program and the builder of the antenna had all kinds of faith that great things were going to happen. And what a humbling experience they had when you go out on a real antenna range that is set up at each one of these conferences and you measure the antenna. Quite often you'll see a grown man cry. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel. K2RIW.
Exactly. I was just going to make a comment about modeling programs that you went go back even quite a number of years ago. They are not the gospel. To prove that fact, there was a conference that time I went to in Washington, D.C., and one of the speakers was Carl Moseley, the owner of Moseley Antennas. And he said, let me tell you something. I get so many comments from hands about antenna modeling and how they modeled one of my antennas that they purchased or have one of their own, and telling me that I have, you know, a distinct mistake. And he said, so what I have done, he was very nice about it. I don't know if it's still there, but he had an antenna test range that was a tower set up out on a field that had a carriage go up and down. And he says, you've got an antenna, any kind of antenna, you want to test it, free of charge, he says, come to my antenna range and prove that your modeling program is so well, you know, working so well. He says, and I'll be interested in buying it. And he says, there's nothing like, again, great, do the paperwork, try the modeling program, but if you want that antenna to really perform, you've got to go out on that test range, Dick. So, as apropos, do not take the mini-neck or the L-neck or any of them as the gospel, because I've found them many times. They, like you say, they get you in the ballpark, but it's hit me up way up in the bleachers, over.
Very good. Thank you, Mel. And Yagi optimization is another one, and there's two or three more of them. They're okay, but they don't do quite as much as everyone thinks they should. And there was another comment I was going to make there, but let's find out what Alex has got to say. N2NNU, what has been bugging you for 3 days, Alex? You normally have these things under control. N2NNU, you got it. Doug recognized. We're going to pick you up in a minute. Alex first, go ahead.
Yeah, here I am on uncharted territory, and I'm scratching my hair and cursing on my blue beard. Sending all those designers of radios and software to hell, sorry for the word, because they design something and they forget the user. They put all kind of technological gimmicks out there, but they forget that somebody has to use them. Well, for the last 3 days, I'm trying to put together a PSK-31 station. So I took my trusted ES-1000 Mark V, dusted it off from the attic. I made out and put it together, and everything works fine on CW and on single slide, and haven't used this machine for ages. Anyhow, downloaded software, the Hama Radio Deluxe, Type in break in the PSK31. Let me drop it. And trying to make some contacts. Make my cable first, and the back of the radio there is a connector, docker connector. Guess what? It doesn't work. Tomorrow I have to yell at ES, so I'm going to call them up on the phone and make them believe that they are in hell. They have a problem with the radio, that the audio source is not really connected where it's supposed to be. Anyhow, got rid of that, so made me a cable to the microphone, and now I transmit and receive. Oh well, it's just that I'm transmitting on frequency and one frequency and receiving another one. I so suspected that NW2 OSR was so nice today and confirmed that with me. I was able to reduce the offset between those two by resetting the whole radio. So I reset to the factory default, but I'm still having about 20 hertz of offset between receive and transmit. And I don't know what, I'm really crying here because I don't understand where it's coming from. I took the menu one line at a time to verify that everything seems to be okay. Then again, 20 hertz between transceive and receive, my transmit and receive might be real difficult to chase down, so that's the problem here, Dick. Can transmit and receive on the same frequency back here?
Okay, I'm going to give you a guess, Alec. I have seen similar things happen with the microwave transverters that guys use. In other words, 144 megacycles is the most commonly used tunable IF for guys that are using a transverter to get them to 902, 1296, 2 gigs, 3 gigs, 5 gigs, 10 gigs. They use a transverter. They use real good voltage regulation on the local oscillator, but almost every transmitter draws considerably more current in the transmit mode than in the receive mode. Therefore, the voltage usually goes down just a little bit. It may only be a fraction of a volt, it may only be a few millivolts, but various power supplies under the greater current drain of transmitting will go to a slightly lower voltage, because the voltage regulator only has a finite amount of gain, not an infinite amount of gain. It doesn't bring everything back exactly to the same spot. Therefore, the reference voltage, a 10 megacycle or whatever it is, reference oscillator for the phase lock loop, that reference oscillator may be changing. If you've got a frequency counter with enough resolution and you put it on the main reference oscillator of the system, be it 10 megs, 8 megs, or whatever it is, 20 megacycles, in some cases it's even 100, but whatever reference frequency is used, it's a crystal-controlled oscillator almost always, if you put a real good counter on it, and you go between the receive mode and the transmit mode, I think there's a chance you will see that reference oscillator move, and in the case of your situation, only has to move by a couple of hertz to get what you're observing. That's one of the things that I would suspect. My guess is you've already tried that. You've already put your frequency counter on there, and you've confirmed that that's not it, and it's something even more deep into the software. So let's see if my guess is right. Into NNU, K2RIW in the tech end.
W2OSR with comments.
Bob recognized, but Alex first. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, okay, Bob. OSR helped me very much today. I think it's time for him to say another word of wisdom here, because I think he will be able to solve that. However, I think it's pertinent to the year, so to the week. Dick, we're talking about a $3,000 radio. You're not supposed to do that stuff. You're supposed to transmit on the same frequency as you're receiving, to the hertz on this guy. So I don't know what to do. You know, I will not open the box. You don't know what you're asking for. If worse comes to worse, I'm going to send it back to repair, but I don't think that's the problem. I think I could probably skew it probably on the offset in the menu somehow, but I'm not sure. I think with your permission, we'll let OSR to say his word.
You've got it, Tom.
Okay, W2OSR. After thinking about this when I was talking to Alex earlier, A couple of things came up in my mind. First of all, most of the receivers have something they call RIT, receiver incremental tuning, and it would make sure that that's properly in the zero setting. The other thing that I thought of, which I doubt is the case, but might be, is if for some reason Alex had his radio set up where it was split, it wasn't split very far on HF. Split transmit on one frequency receive on another, sometimes the X pile up. So those were my two thoughts. Back to you.
Yeah, those are good ones. A $3,000 rig might have receiver incremental tuning. It might have transmitter incremental tuning. And even if those are, these of course should be set to zero for your particular operation. But even if you're not willing to open up the case and measure the frequency of the reference oscillator and see whether it shifts between transmit and receive, which of course it should not, but every rig does. Every rig, the reference oscillator moves to a slightly different frequency when you transmit versus receive. There is no rig that doesn't do that. The only thing left to discuss is it doing it by 20 hertz, 1 hertz, or 20 millihertz. They're all doing it. And your choices are to correct that problem there, which is a difficult thing to correct, or simply compensate. Dial in 20 hertz on the receiver incremental tuning, or the transmitter incremental tuning, would, for the time being, make the problem go away. And some rigs will have a connector on the back panel, which allows you to tap into that oscillator. Or maybe there's a spare pin that's not being used on one of the back panel connectors, and you can put a 1 picofarad capacitor to take or a 1 kilohm resistor to that oscillator so that you can take a sample, if you know what I mean. So there's various ways around this. But the reference oscillator is one of the things I would suspect they all do it. The only thing left to discuss is how much. N2NNU, K2RIW.
K2KEY with a comment.
Okay, Mel, maybe you're familiar with the AC1000. Go ahead, Mel, K2KEY.
Yes, I own one, an FT1000 MT Mark V. I had somewhat maybe a very similar experience. On CW, I was slightly, they had to tune a little bit down for me on CW. And I looked through that book. I went back and forth on that thing. Also, that thing has got a book, stuff in it that you can go for sugar, as Alex said, this will drive you nuts. And finally, one guy I was talking to, he was telling me, he says there's a button on the bottom that says RXTX clear. He says, I want you to hold the two buttons and then push clear. I said, never touched them. I don't know why. Okay. I said, I don't see it, you know, anything really. And I did that. I think that was it. And it, for some reason, it cleared the problem. I may be very similar to what he's looking at, Dick. It has to do with, he explained it, I think he said it was somewhat of an IF shift, you know, some time ago, so I'm just trying to take it off the top of my mind, but I distinctly remember a similar idea, but that was on CW, Dick, over.
Sounds good. Alex, N2NNU, K2RIW.
Yes, I see those buttons, but I didn't think they'd be operational because the RIT is disabled. All the things that could offset on the front panel are disabled. But then again, you never know what those Japanese are doing in there. I'll do that. I'll clear that by pressing the both of them, TX, RX, and clear all three at once, or one at a time. I don't know. We'll see. But the RIT is not engaged now. So, well, Meshuggah is a little bit too mild to what I'm getting here. Back to you, Dick.
A stronger form of craziness. You want to add anything to that, Mel? So you press the R and the T button and the clear, and you're saying, even though in this PSK31 mode, where those RITs are not supposed to be enabled, still, it made the improvement, is what I think you're saying, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Exactly. I shut everything off. I had the filters off, so it says go down, you know, go down, light, little LEDs go down, and it says off. I went down on them off. I make sure that it switches the controls on there, that notch, and all that business, and they got, you know, they got buttons even in the knobs on this rig. They got a button built into the knob on each side. I made sure that was disengaged. I made sure everything, and yet I had that problem. Because I noticed the guys would come back to me. Sometimes they come down a little more. So that way I knew, you know. Other than that, I guess they'd go through a wider filter in some cases and be able to copy me. But I noticed they, and I questioned what's happening there. And that's, I gotta tell you, I also sat with the thing, scratched my head for a while, and all read that book, which is impossible to really follow everything. And then I went over and that button's on the bottom. I pushed it several times. RX, clear, RX, clear, RX, clear, TX, clear, TX, clear. You know, went back and forth a few times with set breaker ready to literally bash them in. And it was so frustrating after a while. And and all of a sudden, there it was. It's gone. And I never had a reoccurrence of it. Take over.
Well done. Let's hope that when Alex does that, it clears it. If not, Alex, don't let this get to you. Without a doubt, step by step, even though you've been very frustrated by it, every one of these problems, there's a way to divide and conquer. And the first thing I would worry about is the reference oscillator moving by a fraction of 1 hertz between the receive mode and the transmit mode? If it's not moving, then we've got something more subtle going on with the software. And maybe that's what Mel's telling you about. Now, Doug signed in earlier. Maybe he's got the previous dipole impedance matching on mine, but let's find out. And Doug, give us enough audio from the A2SAY, K2RIW. Go ahead with your comments.
Hi, Dick. K2RIW, W2SAY. Yeah, I was listening to the program there about matching impedances and so forth. Two comments. I guess the first one is that the largest, I forget the name right now, but the largest manufacturer of mobile antennas uses the W2EL software, or W68, whatever it is, EasyNet, to come up with their antennas. And I know that because I talked to them myself. And the second thing is that I have had reasonably good correlation between designing stuff with EasyNet and actually doing it. And yes, you might have to tweak it a little bit, but it's pretty good. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, what is the most elaborate thing you've ever modeled on EasyNet, Doug? Have you ever modeled, let me pick a number, an 8-element Yagi? And if so, did it really give you the exact impedance match and frequency bandwidth and whatever? Did it really correlate between the model's performance and what you measured on a real antenna range? How about you, Doug? From A2SAY, K2RIW.
Okay, I have to admit I never modeled a real big antenna with this stuff. No, I didn't. I modeled fairly simple antennas, two elements, that kind of thing. An element with a reflector, whatever, you know, a dipole with a reflector, that sort of thing. But it came out pretty good.
Okay, glad to hear that. But still, when you go beyond two elements, the fidelity of the modeling, in my opinion, starts to degrade. And measuring it on a good outdoor antenna range, good indoor antenna range would be the best, but very, very few antenna ranges. There were thousands of antenna ranges in the United States. The ones that work well, below 1,000 megacycles, you can count them on one hand. There are very few. Arguably, the best antenna range on planet Earth is the one at the Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York, and I worked there for a couple of years. I mean, when you set up an antenna range, where you've got billions of dollars worth of equipment on two separate mountains, and a valley in between, a mile and a half between the two, and you set up a full-size airplane on a 50-foot high pedestal. You put the whole damn airplane on top of this pedestal, and you rotate the airplane in azimuth elevation and roll, pitch, and yaw. You move the antenna, you move the whole damn airplane with the antenna you're testing on that airplane, and you make the measurement from a mile and a half away. That's an antenna range. Below 1,000 megacycles, they cease to use that antenna range, and they use the parking lot. And when you realize the physics of what's going on, they're right. They get more accuracy out of the parking lot. Below 1,000 megacycles, a well-calibrated, well-understood, reflective ground plane antenna range. Calibrated, reflective ground plane antenna range. That means you know there's going to be ground reflection. You know that the antenna under test is looking at the real antenna 1,000 feet away, we'll say, and it's looking at the reflection of that antenna as a mirror image in the ground. The same number of degrees below ground as the real one is below above ground. When you set up the geometry of that range correctly, you don't fight the fact that there is an echo off the ground. You use it in your favor, and you calibrate to it. And there's an art and a science to doing that. Dick Turin, W2IMU, wrote an article that was published in QST magazine. You'd be amazed how many military organizations are using the Dick Turin technique. And where is that article available to you? It is hidden in the back of the antenna manual.
Repeater, timeout.
In the ARRL antenna handbook, it's hidden in the back of a chapter on impedance matching, as I remember. It's in the wrong place, but it's there. If you know what to look for, the Dick Turin technique, Dr. Dick Turin of Bell Labs, W2IMU, has this procedure where you use the echo off the ground in your favor. And you think if you're going to raise the antenna on the test real high and the source antenna real high, you're going to make the ground reflection go away? That's the exact opposite thing to do. It's good common sense, dead wrong. In general, you put the source antenna very low to the ground, and there is a specific distance and altitude at which the antenna on the test should be located, so that it can no longer resolve the difference between the image antenna and the real antenna, that's the source. So, as I said, the good outdoor antenna range is the real final acid test, so to speak, the gold standard when it comes to measuring antennas. And the computer modeling program gets you into the ballpark, but on elaborate antennas, it will not get you to home plate. And it's a painful experience for people to find that out. Okay, before we go over to Joe, have we... anyone else with any further questions or comments on the subjects we've discussed so far, give me a call at us right now. K2LAW on the TechNet. Okay, I heard two letters, E-N. Can you give me a little more? Squeeze the mic, wait 2 seconds, then start talking, and tell us what you just said, sir.
Told you A2SAY back once more.
Go ahead, Doug.
I wonder if you've had any experience with 3D modeling programs, the things that, the NET program, the things that you can, to do 3D, spatial modeling. You think of the name of one of them all, and some of them are, I know some of them are defined a little wayside science basis.
I think the answer is yes, Doug. Now, bear in mind that I'm a person who doesn't have a great deal of faith in computer modeling. However, I've worked with people who have a tremendous amount of faith and many years of experience of using it. The $50,000 program, which for a period of time was owned by Hewlett-Packard, called HFSS, High Frequency Structure Stimulator. That $50,000 program, there are a fair number of people who, once they've been through the very long learning curve, that where you have to learn how to get the data in the right format into the machine in order for it to do its modeling. And it takes a pretty powerful machine to really use that one well, particularly if you're doing an optimization program. Most of the time, it gets pretty good results. The very last patent I was involved in involved a simple-looking antenna. Look at the antenna, it's one flat sheet of metal. with a whole bunch of elaborate cuts into that sheet of metal. The sheet of metal has a little bit of the characteristic of a frequency selective circuit. Anyhow, that particular antenna has a peculiar characteristic of so-called stalled frequency phenomena. In other words, over a roughly 10% bandwidth where you tweak the antenna in frequency when you're testing it, the impedance does not move from a single dot on the center of the Smith chart when being displayed on a well-calibrated standing, well-calibrated vector network analyzer. That's an extremely unusual characteristic. It's in defiance of the Bode-Fano equation. It's in defiance of the Chu-Wheeler criteria for antennas, but it does it. And at first we said, okay, we're using a Rodin-Schwarz network analyzer, maybe it's lying to us. We went over to a Hewlett-Packard. We went over to an Aritzu. They all said, yeah, it's doing that. Then we actually connected the antenna to real communication equipment, which is very sensitive to standing wave ratio, and I could tell by the performance of the equipment, the phenomenon was real. What I'm getting at is this particular weird phenomenon, which is it's on the threshold of what's called metamaterials, or you could also call it a negative permittivity material. Anyhow, the antenna has got this peculiar characteristic that over a certain frequency range, which is a very valuable one,
repeater, time out.
It's a very valuable one to me. HFSS would not model and display that phenomenon. It shows a little bit of a trend. It shows that the rate at which it sweeps across the Smith chart when you're sweeping in frequency, HFSS will show you a slowdown phenomenon, but it does not show the stalled impedance. And we seeded the program, we augmented the program in all kinds of ways. It is a frequency, it is a finite element analysis frequency domain program. I've been told that there's another kind of a time domain program, time domain frequency, what's it called now? I can't even think of the four-letter abbreviation for it, but there's a program called CST Microwave Studio, which supposedly uses time domain instead of frequency domain, which some people have told me can do that kind of modeling and might show greater accuracy. Well, that takes another $50,000 license to use that particular program. So for a bunch of reasons, we haven't gone there yet. So certain kinds of very simple-looking antennas that have built into them some real subtle, what's the word I'm looking for now? The elegance of simplicity. But it's a kind of a crazy antenna where there is a loop section and a dipole section which are running simultaneously. And the nice thing about a loop antenna is that when you go up in frequency, it becomes more inductive. It becomes more capacitive. Whereas a dipole antenna, when you go up in frequency, becomes more inductive. They're opposite to each other. If you have just the right ratio of inductive reactance and capacitive reactance, and just the right ratio of the movement of the two, and the two antennas are in parallel, and if you have just the right cross-coupling characteristics between the two sets of elements that are running in parallel, you get the stalled impedance phenomena. It's a real cute characteristic, and we almost had to invent some vocabulary in order to describe the phenomena within the patent disclosure. And so what I'm getting at is there are certain kinds of computer modeling programs that cannot handle that situation. They don't give the right answer. Maybe that's sort of what you're looking for, Doug. As I say, these very elaborate, very expensive programs do some real good work, but even they, at times, run into limitations. From A2SAY, T2LIW.
Hey, Dick, I'm really not all that familiar with that.
Right after we handle Joe's question, I think at the end of the people who signed in with questions, I'll give enough of a delay so that we'll go back to the original question of Bob's, and that is computer modeling accuracy and the work that's being done right now with the presentation that Kent is going to make at the Central State VHF Society, trying to tell people that don't have that much faith in computer modeling programs. They've come a long way. Still got a ways to go, as I see it. Let's see what what's going on with Joe. W-H-U-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W in the tech net.
Good evening, Dick, W-H-U-L-Y-Y.
Yeah, I had a question on
the antenna tubes. I think the subject may have been brought up before, but I'm just trying to understand, get a little better understanding, a little more full understanding of what they're doing. I know they're matching impedances from your transmitter to your antenna circuit, but maybe we can go into this a little more to help you understand it a little better. Okay?
You're on my favorite subject, Joe. There is nothing in the ham radio bag of tricks and the equipment they got to use more important than the antenna. You can have a gold-plated transmitter. You can have the most expensive feed line in the world, the best power in the world, the best location in the world. Everything is the best. If you've got a yucky antenna, you won't transmit very well, and you won't receive very well. I bet you're on the air. So the antenna is damn important, and it is the least understood among the people who are in the business. I have worked with people who have been working for the antenna department of major companies for 20 and 25 years, who have only a partial understanding of what in the world they're doing. Their 25 years of experience have told them that, when you run into a situation, you do this, and it works most of the time. But they don't know what they're doing. Someone has told them this is what you do, and it works most of the time. But what's really happening at the molecular level, at the electron level, so to speak, is a huge mystery for a lot of people. So if you feel uncomfortable about an antenna, anybody who's listening to me, you're in extremely good company. I don't claim to be an expert in the subject, but I've been there. I've watched the operation going on for 35 years. I can tell you an awful lot of what works and what doesn't work. I've developed a number of philosophies of what happens at the molecular level of an antenna. And although I may not have great accuracy in my individual philosophies, silly little models, so to speak, of what's going on, those models have worked for me up till now. They may not be accurate, but they're good enough for the work that I've done, and I'm conveying information to you. Fire away with your question. As I said, it's my favorite subject, Joe. So H-U-L-Y-1, H-U-L-I-W.
Okay, well, take an example and say, I don't have an antenna tuner. I have actually a radio that has an antenna tuner built within the transceiver itself. So this is probably more towards maybe, somebody who has an antenna tuner, as an external device type of thing. But say I have my antenna resonance at, say, 3805. I want to go for the high end of the band at 3975 kilohertz. And I've run into a VSWR problem where the actual return loss, the antenna with the standing wave, becomes 2 to 1, 2.5 to 1. Another antenna unit will make the transmitter match to that line in the antenna circuit. But you said that this power that comes back from the antenna eventually will be radiated back. But, this is what I'm having a little hard time understanding. It's power that's being reflected back from the antenna at the end of the transmission line. So it's always being reflected back at that particular frequency when you're transmitting. So you said this power eventually radiates through the antenna or out from the antenna?
I sure did. And there's a couple of caveats to that, but I'll explain it to you. Let's assume that you've tuned your antenna to 3805. You're happy with its performance. It's giving you a 1.2 standing wave ratio. The average guy is quite happy with a 1.2. which probably represents something like a 20 decibel reflection coefficient. In other words, 1% of the power is being reflected. You put 100 watts forward and 1 watt is coming back, and it's something like a 1.2 standing wave ratio. The average guy would be very happy with that. You then take that exact same dipole at that exact same altitude, QSY up to 3975, and now the antenna is a 2 to 1 VSWR, which means that a little bit more than 10% of the power is now being reflected. And that's not a showstopper, but it's less than the ideal efficiency. The transmitter, particularly if it's a solid-state transmitter, can become very unhappy with 2 to 1 standing wave ratio. 10% of the power coming back to a certain degree on a solid-state transmitter that has no real tuning of its final stage. Back in the old days, your DX100 Heathkit or your Collins transmitter had a real tuning and loading control, a real Pi tank network, where you could match anything from 20 ohms to 200 ohms, so to speak, of antenna with quite a bit of reactant. You properly adjust the tuning and loading control, and everything went away, so to speak. The transmitter gave you full power output, The rig was happy. He didn't run out of range on those controls. And if the rig was rated for 100 watts output, 99 watts was going out that antenna. That's the way it used to be. Let me drop. So along comes these very compact, no-tune, solid-state transmitters. The good news is they're small.